From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. All right, if you guys are just coming into the show for the first time, welcome. Thank you guys so much for tuning in and listening. I am Jake Skorheim, your host. It is a pleasure to hang out with you guys every single night and get to do this Monday through Friday, 7 to 10, every single night. We just get to like come in here and hang out. I get to drink decaf coffee at this time of night. I don't drink caffeinated coffee past about 4 o'clock in the afternoon because then I would be up until 2 o'clock in the morning. But I do get to sit here. I get to drink decaf coffee and just hang out with you guys, tell stories, talk about things that you're interested in, laugh about things. So I hope that you guys are enjoying it as well. Do me a favor, though. Before we get into the news roundup, which is something we do every single night at this time, go download the podcast if you haven't already. If you don't think you're going to have a chance to listen to the entire show, which is totally fine, I don't blame you, although I do blame you a little bit. We got a great podcast. We put it together every single night after the show. We usually have 3 new episodes every single night taken from portions of the show that we do every night. It's great. It's high quality HD audio. You can listen to it. It's like I'm living inside your head. And who wouldn't want this voice inside their head, right? Right? Maybe not. All right, so let's get into the news roundup. We got a lot of great stuff to talk about today. Basically, what the news roundup is, for anybody unfamiliar, we look at all the other shows, we find out what they were talking about, and then it gives us a chance to figure out what we might have missed, and then we get to talk about it too. All right, on Seattle's Morning News, Greg Tomlin was talking about aging rock stars. What about them?
4-time Grammy Award-winning rockers Aerosmith have announced a show in Seattle for this August at Climate Pledge Arena. The Northwest engagement will be part of the Peace Out Tour, which is an appropriate title given lead singer Steven Tyler is 76 years old. So why don't these musicians...
Whoa, I gotta pause it there real fast. Is Steven Tyler 76 years old? I remember... The only thing I remember about Steven... a couple things. Number one, he's a guy with crazy lips, right? Isn't that Steven Tyler? I think his daughter is Liv Tyler. I know that she's Liv Tyler. Do you guys remember the soundtrack for Armageddon? I don't want to close my eyes. That song hit, what was that, 1999 maybe that song came out? So I would have been like a freshman in high school. That was just directed at me. That movie, everything about that movie, I loved it. It was fantastic. It was fun. I think it still holds up. Although I haven't probably seen that movie in 20 years, but I imagine it still holds up. I can watch it back in my head. That's still pretty good. I still think it's a pretty good movie. The premise is good. I liked how they filmed it, but it was the soundtrack. Steven Tyler singing whatever that song was. I don't know the name of the song. Very good song. So, all right, we'll get back to Greg Tomlin here.
Do something like retire to some beach in the Caribbean or retreat to a French villa to drink the finest wines and complete their final days in rest and relaxation. I think there's a more profound dynamic that's at play here. As a musician myself, I had pipe dreams of superstardom as a kid and imagined myself on a stage one day touring the world, playing songs to the masses. But when childhood fantasies didn't pan out, my love of music started to wane in my 20s. After I stopped playing, I found myself with a bit of a music-shaped hole in part of my heart, which nothing else could really replace. I soon realized I had turned music into a means to an end, rather than an end in itself. After this epiphany, I returned to playing music anytime and anywhere I could. At home in my office, at church in the form of worship, at dive bars, or on stage at some bigger venue. It didn't matter. The joy I began to derive from the act itself offered a level of satisfaction and fulfillment that no byproduct of music would ever come close to. I can't help but wonder if some of these aging rock stars have come to a similar conclusion, which keeps them coming back to the stage after all these years. In the song American Pie, Don McLean pondered, "Do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul?" I don't know about that. But maybe trying to understand what motivates these artists to keep playing after all these years can bring us closer to the answers.
That's a really interesting conversation that Greg kind of posits there. A good question that he posits for us there. Why would somebody like Steven Tyler, who, what do you say, 76 years old, which is crazy to think about. Why would somebody like Steven Tyler still be doing it after all these years? Or look at the Rolling Stones. Like, how old are those Rolling Stones guys? They're like 99 years old. I don't know if they actually are, but they're very, very old. Why would they still climb up on stage with their rickety bones and walk around? You know they're tired. You know they're not feeling like, you know, super excited to do it all the time. But the endorphin rush that they must get going out on a stage and singing these songs. The other question I would have about that is, how do you sing these same songs for 50 years? So my family and I, my parents and I went to, and my wife and I, and both of our parents, my parents and her parents, that would be both of them. We went to go see Paul McCartney when he was in Seattle. I think it was back in 2010, if I'm not mistaken. I've talked about it a couple times on the show. It was really like not a defining moment in my life, but it was a super memorable moment in my life because a couple of reasons. I was there with my parents. I'm able to look over and see them enjoying something on like a whole different level because they'd been listening to that music their entire life. But I had also been listening to that music my entire life. Like Paul McCartney and the Beatles were just like completely normal, like ubiquitous songs to hear in my household growing up. Like we listened to the oldies on 97.3 FM back when it was the oldies. Now it's talk radio. It's where you're listening to me right now. And we used to listen to that station all the time. We'd be listening to the Beatles. We played the records. My parents had the CDs. So when we got the opportunity to hear Paul McCartney play in person, sing in person, we were so excited. I was so excited to get to have that experience with my parents and to see something live that is not forever because none of us are going to last forever. The truth is that like none of us know if like tomorrow is not promised to any of us. You could get hit by a bus. You could die from cancer, any number of things. And so to take the opportunity to do something that was going to be memorable, was going to like be a lifelong memory, which I will hold on to for the rest of time. Even when my parents are gone, when they're no longer with us, when my wife's parents are no longer with us, my wife and I can still look back and go, do you remember that warm August night? Might've been July or June. I don't remember what it was, summery. Do you remember that warm summer night when we went to, what was at the time called Safeco Field? And we sat in the nosebleed section and we watched Paul McCartney sing his heart out for 3 hours with a half hour encore. It was unbelievable. And what I think probably is what Greg is talking about, what these guys are capturing is not just their love of music. I don't think that's it because the songs are this, they're playing the same songs over and over again. Like how exciting could that be? It's like if I had a funny segment that I did on the show that was word for word the same and I came out and I did it every single night, I told the same thing, you would get bored, I would get bored. There's something different about music and the association of music and what it means for people's lives. And so when you have a guy like Paul McCartney on stage, it's not just because he loves music, and I'm sure he loves music, obviously. He's been doing it for a long time. He's made billions of dollars doing it, or Steven Tyler. I don't think it's just about getting up there and singing. I think what they're also doing is they are reflecting the love. That's the part that I think would be addicting. It's not just the playing of the music because you like playing music. The love that those guys are getting from the audience members that are just like Care Bears, just shooting it out of your stomach at these guys, and they in turn are just reflecting it right back. That would be addicting. That would be a tough thing to say goodbye to. And to stop playing, if that meant that you had to stop playing music and you would no longer get that, like that would be a really tough thing to do. You get up on that stage and you are immortal. Paul McCartney, when he played that night in Seattle, that guy was immortal. He was 24 years old again, playing those songs. In our eyes, he had not aged a day and he sounded great and he looked great. And we were all having this like wonderful shared experience, which is kind of a unique experience to going to live music and something you just really can't get with anything else. So I don't know if that answers the question that Greg was asking, why do these musicians keep doing this? I think in some way that they're tapping into, some life force that you get up on that stage. And that would be pretty addicting. All right, G and Ursula, they're talking about group housing. How's that for a segue? Let's get to it.
It's houses before spouses.
Okay.
Some members of the Gen Z folks are choosing to buy homes with their friends before they even think about getting married. Stephanie, who's purchased multiple homes with friends, tells the New York Post, for women in their 20s, it's common to hear, I'm just waiting until I get married to buy a house, or I'm waiting for a partner to buy a house. No, she started a company with a friend back in 2019 to help young people get into a home with their friends. The reason why this article stood out to me is because this needs to be said and talked about every single day. You want to talk about a fast way to fast track into the real estate market. I think doing this with your friends is great. Example.
You need a good attorney, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need you need someone to have it spelled out.
No problem. Yeah. But if it's four or five of you, and because I know I've had friends where all we did was go play video games, or I've had friends that all we did was go hit happy hour. If you can get the same friends, those four to five friends, happy hour and or video games or something else, you can get those same friends, hopefully, to go and buy a house and you get in it. This is genius, Ursula.
I love the idea, but I think that there could be a lot of pitfalls, which is why I would say that you need to make sure that you have all your ducks in a row.
Ursula's totally right. And G's right, too. I think this is a really cool idea. I see a lot of benefits to this. But what Ursula was saying about making sure that you have an ironclad real estate attorney look at this agreement that you would sign with these friends. Like, one of the great things is when you get married, all of your life is already tied together. So you have this vested interest to be successful together. You're on the same path. Even if you have different careers, you're all rowing in the same direction. One of the things that could be difficult, you start to buy a house with a group of friends, and, you know, in a way that it's different than just meeting up to play video games together or going out to a happy hour, as G was referencing there. You know, those are very low risk activities. Those are fun to do. They're great. It's about building friendship. It's about having meaningful time with each other. But it's very low risk because at the end of the night, you go home to your own individual lives. If you were to then intertwine those friendships with finances and you were to buy a house together, I think it could get really, really tricky. Like, let's say one of you, of your five friend group, let's say there's five of you. And so you're going to buy a house that costs $500,000 at the modern, what is the interest rate right now? Like 7.3, 7.4%. What is $500,000 at 7.4%? Like $4,000 a month, $5,000 a month? I don't know those numbers. You check those out. Let's just throw that out there. Let's say it's $5,000 a month for the interest rate for a home loan. The five of you obviously probably are going to be able to qualify for some sort of a home loan. You probably have to form some sort of a LLC or something so that they think that you are a single entity. Then you buy the house. Now you're each responsible for $1,000 a month. But then, and maybe you're renting it out too. Like maybe that's your thing that kind of like offsets it and makes it a little more manageable for you guys because you're going to have somebody renting it, which then means that you're going to have somebody who's actually paying your mortgage, which is the best situation that you could be in. Although there are some hassles that come with renters. But let's say you do something like that. Still, you want to make sure that you are not going anywhere, that you don't need that money for the next 20 years, that you don't care about it, or that you all have some agreement that the first time somebody says, I got to get money out of this house, you all agree to either buy them out and have the means to buy them out, or you all agree to sell the house. But then resentments might form because you might go like, hey, well, you know what? I don't need this money right now. I'd rather hold on to this house as a long-term investment. Somebody else says, well, you know, I've met somebody. I'm going to get married. And we want to make sure that we're, setting our family up for the best future that we can set ourselves up for. So I need to pull myself out of this group of five and this home ownership thing. So I need to figure out how to get out of this, guys. Can you just buy me out? And they're like, all right, well, what's it cost to buy you out? And you say, well, I'd want 1/5 of whatever the current value of the house is. We bought it at 500, but the market got crazy and now the house is worth $1 million. So I need $200,000 for my value in this house. And then the other four friends are like, well, wait a minute. Like, where are we going to come up with $200,000 to pay this person off just to get them out from this house? There's a lot of headaches involved. It can be really great if you have a good lawyer and you guys all agree and you can figure out how, like, you know, you don't have to have all these monthly payments. That I think that could work, possibly. But it's also a headache. So what I would recommend is find somebody that you love, get married, buy a house together, and then buy a second house and buy a third house and get people to rent those houses. That's a lot easier said than done. I get it, but that would be my recommendation. All right, let's see here. We have time for another one real fast. Jack and Spike, they were talking about an octopus garden. What is this?
A dentist in Edmond, Oklahoma, said his son Cal has been infatuated with octopuses since he was 13 years old. Now, that is one of the signs of being a sociopath. And that child needs locked care. So he said every like birthday, every Christmas, every holiday, all he would say always was, all I want is an octopus. So the last October, Clifford, the father, he sprang for the real deal. He bought himself a California two-spot octopus to keep in as a pet in a tank, and then it spontaneously gave birth.
I didn't know you could have octopus as
well. Or a, point or, being like is legal. That this kid is now having to deal with a lot of little octopuses because they have to feed them all and they have to change the salt water.
What is the plural of octopuses? Is it octopi? Is that possible, or is it octopuses?
Tank, which is a 10-gallon saltwater tank.
And when you say a lot, it's 50.
50 babies.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And
well, don't octopi. Don't they die after they give birth?
Yeah.
I know a lot about nature.
Laura,
don't...
you know all this stuff,
I do, because
right?
I used to work at the Seattle Aquarium. They are terminal maters, and they also typically have, and they're lucky it was only 50, because usually they can have up to 1,000 eggs, and then they just hope that maybe 3 or 4 survive to adulthood. Octopuses don't usually live longer than a few years, and after they care for the eggs, which are basically like plankton, like these little baby eggs are the tiny little octopus. I looked at one under a microscope once. That's how little they are. But once they've cared for the eggs, usually within like a year,
they're gone.
Yeah.
Is this kid now, I mean, is he going to have to raise these 50 little octopi alone?
He's got them all in little Tupperwares in the tank.
He's going to have to raise these 50 octopi. Like, how do you do that? How do you raise 50 octopi? I hope this. I've actually seen pictures of this. They're adorable. They're tiny, tiny. They're like the size. They're like on his fingertip. It's crazy how tiny they are and really small. I didn't realize that only so few would survive. So I hope more than 3 survive. That makes me very sad. This reminded me though. Do you remember the movie Octopussy with the James Bond movie? I think it was 1983, the year of my birth. Octopussy came out. Such a great movie. One of the more underrated Bond movies. I know this wasn't the point of this news roundup, was to talk about Octopussy, but that one was really good. What was the one with Timothy Dalton where he is Bond? I think Timothy Dalton was an awesome Bond. Am I getting that name right? Timothy Dalton? I'm just thinking of the one. There was like one where he was trying to work with a cellist who was also a spy. I don't remember the exact plot of the movie, but it was fantastic. And his car in the movie... Oh my gosh, I wish I could remember the name of the movie right now. Whatever the Timothy Dalton was, hit me up on the text line, 888-973-5476. A Time to Kill, is that right? No, that can't be it. All right, thank you guys so much for listening to the News Roundup. We have a lot more coming up. We're going to talk to Jason Rance next. He's going to tell us about all the stuff that's happening, all these protests that are going on. Stick around. Right back here on Cairo Nights.
You're listening to Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. It's Friday night. This is one of my favorite guys to talk to because he's just a fun guy to just have around. Felix Bunnell. Thanks for hanging out, man.
That's my job description. It says if you go to the Bonneville Files in Salt Lake City, it says Felix Bunnell has my social security number. It says just a fun guy to have around.
Isn't that the kind of guy you want to be? Don't you want to just be a guy who people like having around?
Yeah, I mean, like there'd be some substance along with the fun.
Well, that's why you're fun to have around. Okay. Yeah, though you always have great substance. In fact, the reason we're talking now is because you have kind of a fun, mysterious story. I think last time we talked, we were talking about a mystery cabin. And now we are talking about some mystery photos that were found in Sandpoint. Is that right?
They're about Sandpoint. They were found in Seattle. So Magnuson Park is the big park on Lake Washington, sort of, you know, north of the city, east of University District, right? It's this multiple hundred acres. But it was a Navy base from the 1920s up until the 1970s and had a big airstrip. All this military aviation stuff happened there. And there's some photographs of it. It's fairly well documented, right? There's, you know, like when this around the world flight took off in 1924 and came back a couple months later when this big Soviet airplane visited in the late 20s. There's some like there's newspaper photos. It's relatively well documented.
Yeah.
But this woman, Carol Mandel, she moved back here recently, moved back into her family home. Turns out her great uncle, who died back in 1935 when he was only 30, A few years before that, in 1929, just after he graduated from the UW, he was a naval cadet, like learning to fly at Sand Point.
Oh, really?
And he was a photographer.
So you know what? I didn't even know that about Sand Point. Because I'm not.
There's so much hidden aviation history. That was the first place Boeing delivered airplanes. They would truck stuff from the factory to Sand Point, like wings and the fuselage, and bolt it all together out there on the grass.
And then they would take off there.
And they'd deliver it to the government or deliver it to whoever the private buyer was. That's like Boeing. That's the cradle of Boeing history. Is in that dog park.
I had
no
idea.
There's so much, and there's Navy hangars and stuff. There's some stuff left from like the 1930s.
It looks like some executive buildings or some sort of office.
Some really cool kind of art deco, kind of art modern old hospitals, the old officers club, that sort of thing. The big gatehouse was built around 1940, right there at the front gate there.
Yeah, I remember it because when I was young, living in Seattle, not a kid.
That's right, you're not young anymore.
Oh, yeah, I'm not young anymore, Jake. But when I was 20 something and I was here. That's where my friends and I would go to, you could rent boats and stuff.
There's a terrific aquatic center is fabulous.
The aquatic center right there is unbelievable. Yep. You can rent like little sailboats and you can go out on the water and I think it's part of Seattle Parks Department maybe.
And there might be a private organization that does it, but it's all open to the public. But see, because when they opened the locks and the level of the lake dropped about 9 feet, it created all this new land at that peninsula. There was going to be a public park there, but they're also, in the time of World War I, they're realizing aviation was a threat. We needed to have some way to defend ourselves against whatever enemy was going to come flying in from somewhere.
Yeah.
So the Navy was looking for a place to put up a Navy base. King County, you know, they saw an opportunity to have the Navy here. They bought the property and kind of put the package together and essentially gave it to the Navy in the early 20s.
That's so cool.
And the Army was there for a while. You know, Charles Lindbergh, when he went on his victory tour after he flew across the Atlantic, he touched down there with the Spirit of St. Louis on the grass runway there.
The Spirit of St. Louis landed at Sand Point.
It was parked in an old hangar that was at Sand Point. The Navy brought this cool surplus hangar up in 1923, I think. And it was there for about 10 years. It got taken apart. It's still in use over at Port Townsend at the airport there. This incredible hangar that's more than 110 years old, I think. It was built in the teens. Anyway, that's where they parked the Spirit
of
St. Louis.
That's in Port Townsend?
Yeah.
My in-laws live in Port Townsend. I've been to that hangar.
There's a place called Tailspin Tommy's is in there. It's like an aircraft maintenance facility right next to the airport, which used to be the old Fort Townsend airstrip when the Army was there back in the 30s.
You know what's so cool? And this is a total sidetrack, but that airport that you're talking about now,
yeah,
they have this really cool program at that airport where this guy, and if you're ever interested in doing a story, I can put you in touch with him. But he has basically started this program where he takes kids who have no background in aviation at all. And he says, hey, if you guys come and work for me and if you come and do, you know, sweep up around here or whatever, I will not only he gives them the job, but he also he teaches them to fly.
That's cool.
And very so
cool.
Then these kids all end up graduating high school. It's like kind of like a 4-H club, but with planes.
Neat.
They all end up graduating high school with pilot's licenses.
Wow.
And they can go into the aviation industry, which is just, you know, booming, and they always need aviators. And like, that's, if you want to be a professional pilot, that's a great place
to start. Yeah.
And so
very
he takes
cool.
these kids from like maybe disadvantaged backgrounds and things that wouldn't have access to this otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
And he teaches them, and it's all happening at the place like where sounds like Charles Lindbergh has his plane in there. How cool is that?
Yeah, the hangar was moved from Sand Point. But yeah. So this aviator, this guy, his name was Ludwig Schroeder. He was he was just a kid, 25 in 1929. He's out at Sand Point.
He's not German, is he?
there's some debate about that. No. So he's at 29. He's a pretty active photographer, and he's taking close-up pictures like this big Soviet plane visited in 1929. It was like either a goodwill mission or a propaganda effort, depending which side you were on.
Yeah.
They sent this giant two-engine Soviet float plane. It had kind of hopscotched down from Alaska. It stopped at Sand Point to have its floats changed to wheels. And they parked it in the hangar there, and he got some close-up pictures of it on the runway. There was a rumor about this plane that like Boeing engineers had spied on it and gone over it like and taken kind of reverse engineered it and then used it to inform Boeing designs a year or two later.
Yeah.
Totally bogus.
But of course.
Those claims were made up by the Soviets in like the 1950s.
Yeah.
That the Americans had stolen this technology. And you look at this plane, it's based on some like 1919 German Junkers design or something. It looks like a Soviet plane. It's all corrugated metal. There's a cockpit up on top. It looks like something out of a cartoon.
Yeah.
Anyway, that landed there.
Do you remember the Antonov, the Soviet plane, the Antonov?
The Antonov, yeah, yeah.
Is that
the giant
Antonov,
one that burned in the hangar?
It burned in the hangar. It was in Ukraine.
Yeah,
it got burned in the hangar. I saw that. Do you remember when that came into Seattle?
I do remember that. You got when to see that?
Oh. I got my dad took me because we love aviation in the Skorham household. Okay. So we went out, we saw that, and that was another Soviet big giant aircraft.
Exactly. This is the 1929 version of it. And it's an ANT-4. And what's that? Andrei Nikolaev Tupolev's, because there's Antonov is one of the big Soviet designers.
Yes.
Tupolev's the other one. Yeah. They're like the Boeing and Airbus.
They've been at it for a while. Yeah.
Exactly.
They're like Boeing, just less successful.
Yeah. And he took all these great pictures of like plane crashes. I don't think anybody was killed or hurt, but there are these close-up pictures of these ancient Navy float planes, like on their nose, floating in the water, being pulled out of the lake with cranes. Again, we've heard about this stuff. We knew this stuff was happening. No one's ever seen photos of this stuff. And they're good photos. The guy was a good photographer. It's unclear if he was doing his own darkroom work and enlarging and stuff, or if he's just using Bartels or whatever.
Yeah.
But he actually took some pretty amazing photos. There's two albums worth. There's several people in the images. It's not clear who they are. There's one that's sort of a female aviator. We're not sure if she's someone's mom who got to go for a fun flight one day, or if it's, some other Amelia Earhart type person. There's an amazing actual professional photograph taken by Aishel Curtis, who's the brother of Edward Curtis, the guy famous for all the indigenous photos.
Oh, okay.
But it's a big panoramic shot of all the squadron parked out there on where that seaplane ramp is now, kind of where that sailing center is you're talking about, on the north part of Sand Point. And they're all lined up, and it's just, it's one of these cameras that probably had a roll of film where you had to twist it while you took the picture. It's probably 3 feet long or something. And it's a beautifully composed photograph of this airplane squadron. Nobody's seen this stuff
before.
And she
just found these in a family photo book her house.
And uncle, she said they never talked about her uncle. Because about 5 years after he was trained at Sand Point, he died in a Navy crash. He was in the Naval Reserves somewhere off the California coast. And so he's been sort of not exactly forgotten, but he wasn't a guy who was, part of the typical discourse of good old Uncle Ludwig. It was just something that he was known of. But they held on to his stuff. She has all his logbooks, all his pilot licenses from the 20s and stuff. So it's a pretty amazing archive.
I think that is an amazing story.
And the family, her dad has a great story too. He was a LTA navigator, aviator, lighter than air aviator in World War II. I mean, he flew blimps.
Oh, wow. So I love blimps.
And then her daughter's a pilot too. Her daughter's a commercial pilot. There's four generations of pilots in this family. And they have these photo albums. They don't want to hand them over to anybody yet, but I think someday, my hope is, and I think they'll do this. They'll give it to the Museum of Flight or somewhere where these pictures, which are just priceless and understanding.
That'd be so cool.
Because that Sandpoint history, it's just, there's so much hidden there. There's very little interpretation. I think it should be a national park. I think you could do a Cradle of Aviation National Park, maybe affiliated with whatever they have in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina or something. But it's all about kind of how it grew here from this effort of the government, King County, private citizens, and the Boeing company kind of coalesce and track the Navy here. Then all this amazing aviation stuff happened.
I just had no idea that they had that connection to history like that. I mean, I know that, our area is kind of like this really fertile cradle of aviation.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I had no idea that, Lindbergh landed his plane there. I mean, when you start thinking about history like that, how cool that we have that. It's just right there.
And there's film footage of Lindbergh landing that was donated about 5 or 6 years ago to the University of Washington from the local family that had a big fireworks factory in the Rainier Valley. They had a 16-millimeter camera, and they shot some pretty incredible footage of the Spirit of St. Louis. It kind of buzzes the field a few times and comes in for a landing, and they show up being pushed into the hangar, and then Lindbergh standing there with Mayor Bertha Landis.
I love it.
Female mayor at the time.
That's so fun.
It's all this stuff's connected. It makes my head kind of hurt when I
start it's so fun because, they find she finds this old photo book, and her uncle, who passed away, tragically.
Yep.
But now he has this amazing legacy. How many? 70 years after he passed?
Almost 80, I think.
80 years after he passed.
Almost 90.
It's like finding a treasure map. It's like, this is how you find treasure. And it's very cool. I love these stories.
I love people to go to My Northwest and look at the story. There's images there. If you see something that you recognize, because there's lots of aviation people like your family and my family, we love aviation and aviation history.
Yeah, if you recognize
take a look at the photos.
Someone.
If you recognize the kinds of planes or the people who are in the pictures, I would love to hear about it.
Cool. All right. That's Felix Bunnell. He's always got great stories. Felix, thanks for hanging out, man.
My pleasure.
You're a good guy to hang out with. That's what it says on his resume.
That's what it says on the door of my office. If I had an office here at Cairo, that's what it would say.
I'm going to talk to someone. We're going to get you an office. All right. We got a lot more coming up. Stick around. We're going to be right back here on Cairo Nights.
You're listening to Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Are you a happy person? That's a question I have for you right now. There's a new study out, and they think they have stumbled upon the formula for happiness in life. And it's kind of funny because it's actually not far off what a lot of people would just guess.
are the happiest people in life? I'll get to that in a second. I'm going to give you the answer. Who according to this study, like 12,000 participants they surveyed, and they were really trying to like figure out, all right, what is actually making somebody satisfied? What makes somebody happy? But do you think that you're a happy person?
Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
Yeah, I wish I had more of that song. That song makes me happy. All right, so in this study, researchers set out to understand all the different variables which lead to high degrees of happiness, satisfaction. Again, 12,000 participants were in the study who included, the breakdown of those were including working and non-working adults, all between the ages of 25 and 64. The participants were surveyed across a range of categories, including family, work, education, income, life satisfaction, social class, general interests. One of the most surprising findings was, I actually don't find this one super surprising, but they find it surprising. According to this article, one of the most surprising findings was the importance physical appearance plays in life satisfaction. This is according to the researchers. So basically what they're saying is, I'll just read their quote here. Although others may rate someone highly attractive, what matters more is how satisfied a person is with their own appearance. Something that could be more difficult today in a world of social influencers and social media in which appearance has an outsized role, which is what the team said in a statement. It's interesting to me that the happiest people, it turns out, and there are some like exceptionally happy people here, but like the happiest people they say are people who like the way that they look. It's interesting because I don't find it surprising. I would just assume, like if you were to ask me like, oh, do you think somebody's happier if they think that they're ugly or if they think that they're attractive? I would imagine the person who thinks that they're attractive probably are happier, because they like what they see when they're looking in the mirror. All right, so here's some other things that made people happy. They talked about family time and being part of a community outside of work and having people to depend on were also very high impacts on life satisfaction. So those were things that like really, really made you feel very happy. Income plays a role, but it's not the most important one. The one that they say is the most important is the community family influence, which actually I find really fantastic. And I find that to be true. Like the times in my life when I'm feeling the best, when I think back and look at the you know, what really makes me feel satisfied as a person, it all has to do with my, especially now with that I have a family, it all has to do with the people that I love. So like I feel exceptionally satisfied when my wife is happy with me. No secret there. And when my kids are, you know, listening to me, not only just listening to me, but like also when I'm getting good quality time with my kids, when it's not just like rushed and we're not just yelling at each other to like get the shoes picked up or to get the backpack on for school, but when we're actually spending time together, those are the times that I go like, oh man, this is the best. Rarely is it about money. Like money can certainly make you feel bad when you don't have it, but having money versus having a satisfying family life is two very different things. And I much prefer a satisfying family life. But according to this study, 12,000 people surveyed, working and non-working, 25 to 64, the happiest people on the planet are women who consider themselves to be upper class, who have families, who also consider themselves to be attractive. Which is so just attractive women with families, attractive upper class women with families, so like rich women who like their families. Like, yes, yeah, obviously you're going to like your life. You're going to feel pretty happy. Interesting study. So I hope that you guys are very satisfied, and I find it very satisfying to do the show and hang out with you guys. So you are a part of my happiness, and I thank you for that.